The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Every year, more people die of heart disease in the U.S. than any other ailment. Recently, a team of researchers discovered that genetic mutations might provide a clue to creating new treatments for heart disease, and in the process, save lives. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet a UWM researcher who's using his love of math to help answer some perplexing questions about why our hearts give out well before their time. Joining us in the studio is Paul Auer, Assistant Professor of Biostatistics in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health. Paul, welcome. Good to have you on today's program.
Thanks. It's my pleasure to be here.
And so you're a statistician, and your story today is that mathematics may give us perhaps a broader view of some of the factors that are behind the heart disease that is causing so much heartache, truly, literally, for people in this country.
That's right. So the recent study that we've conducted basically collects a lot of data, an enormous amount of data, and so you need statistics and mathematical tools to basically wade your way through the data and find some answers.
Because normally a cardiologist, a physician who's treating me or you in the office is looking at me or you, one person, and your role is to perhaps zoom way back and get a look at many, many more than just a handful of people.
Right. So we're sort of in the business of discovery. So we want to try to find new ways or new ways to think about why people develop heart disease. And in order to do that, we might look at tens of thousands of people. That's what we did in particular for this study.
Well, let's talk about the study itself. The results were just published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Gained a lot of attention actually around the world. Let's share with our listeners exactly what was involved here.
Sure. So we looked at we looked at the DNA of about 7,000 individuals. And this took several years. It was a multi-year undertaking. Probably about 100 different people were involved in it, cardiologists, as you just mentioned, statisticians, and some bench scientists. And so we measured their DNA and got their brief medical history from these individuals. And then the statisticians in the group sort of scoured the DNA or looked through it using lots of computers and lots of mathematical algorithms to find if there is a link between the genetics and the development of heart disease. And we found a specific gene that we think is involved in the development of heart disease, and that was really the major finding of the study.
Talk about that gene. What is it that was the anomaly that you found?
Sure. So there's a gene. It's called APOC3. And what we first discovered was that a few individuals, it's quite rare, they carry these mutations that significantly lower those individuals' triglyceride levels. And so throughout the course of their entire life, they, no matter what they eat, no matter what their lifestyle is, they have low triglyceride levels. And what we found was that these people, in addition to having low triglyceride levels, which is a type of fat in the blood, it's similar to LDL or low-density cholesterol or high-density cholesterol. Some people might be familiar with those things. People with low triglycerides were also had a much less chance to develop heart disease throughout their life. And so this is sort of the gene that we found, and it sort of gives us an insight into the biological underpinnings of developing heart disease, because we don't necessarily understand completely why people do develop heart disease, and this is sort of a clue.
So is there any sense that this gene is handed down within the families of the individuals whom you studied? Is this just a mutation and it's a one-off?
No, this is definitely a heritable mutation. So this is passed down through families. And what we found in previous research is it's actually quite a bit more common in Lancaster Amish populations in Pennsylvania. just due to population demographics and so forth, population dynamics.
So the discovery is that that this gene is playing a role in lowering the triglycerides, and so the natural question is, can we make that? Can we figure out a way to see if we could replicate that for those of us who don't have that gene that is functioning in that fashion?
Right. So knowing the mutations that these individuals carry, they sort of destroy the function of this gene called APOC3. So in most people, their APOC3 gene functions just fine. But in these individuals who have these mutations, the APOC3 gene just simply does not work. And that ends up being a good thing for them in terms of their risk for developing heart disease. So the theory is that maybe we can mimic through a therapeutic or maybe a drug, mimic the effect of knocking out the function of this particular gene. And if we can do that, we would we might see a decreased risk of heart disease for people.
Does that gene regulate anything else? I mean, does anything bad happen because it essentially is turned off in this group of people?
Right. So actually, the gene produces a chemical called APOC3. And this has to do with sort of clearance of fats in your blood. And when you turn that gene off or you don't have that APOC3 circulating, it's actually good for you. And when we looked at these individuals, so that's a very good question, is there some sort of side effect that might happen, right? They were apparently healthy otherwise. So these individuals lived their entire life without a functioning APOC3 gene, and they were apparently healthy otherwise. And in addition, they had much lower risk for developing heart disease.
You talked about 7,000 people involved in this study. Was this centered all in the United States, or have you replicated or included in your study people from other parts of the world?
Right. So the initial discovery, when we first found from the 7,000 individuals, that was done in the U.S. It was a broad sample of the population. But once we made the initial discovery, we wanted to replicate it and see if it was valid across multiple populations and independent samples. And then we looked worldwide.
And similar findings?
Similar, almost exactly the same findings. It was uncanny almost.
In any sense that in other parts of the world that some cultures or some nationalities are more likely to have this gene turned off than others?
Right. So as I mentioned before, there is the small population of Amish in the U.S., and I believe they're I actually don't know the answer to that or whether or not this is more common in other populations, but it's certainly plausible.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a bit about how you got involved in this study. You're a relatively new member of the Zilber School of Public Health, come here already involved in the study from your previous work, or did you begin that work in your time here in Milwaukee?
Right. So I had started this project 3 or 4 years ago, actually, and this sort of project takes, as you might imagine, takes quite a long time. So just collecting the data takes a good 2 or 3 years. And so we started this in about 2010, 2011, and we wrapped up a good 5 or 6 months ago with sort of putting all the findings together. So it took 4 years.
Oh, that's a long, long period of your life to be devoted to a project. Huh?
Sure, yes. But it was a very satisfying ending.
Talk about biostatistics. It's a relatively new term to me anyway. I never heard much about it a few years ago, but it is now very common for health organizations to have people like you who are studying these massive amounts of data, isn't it?
Sure. So one way to think about it is we basically analyze data in the most clever way that we can think of. And in healthcare and health and public health in general, there's been a recent push to have things be evidence-based and to collect a lot of data to inform your policy decisions or what have you. And in order to – once you've collected that data, in order to make sense of it, that's where the sort of biostatistician – that's where their role comes in. And we implement algorithms or mathematical tools to sort of wade through the data and give suggestions or inferences to the primary researcher who's asking the question, whoever's collecting the data.
How do you start if you have a mound of detail? I mean, you talked about finding this one gene that in this case was not functioning, and that's a good thing in terms of its impact on collection of fats in our body. But we have a lot of genes in our body. I mean, how does a statistician begin to essentially find this needle in the haystack?
Sure. That's a very good question. So, first of all, there's been a huge technological advance in the past 5 years, both for sequencing individuals' genomes, because this was simply not possible more than 5 years ago. So there's been a huge technological advance in order to just sort of gather the data. And then how do you search for this needle in the haystack? Well, you basically you write a computer program, and then you have basically thousands of computers churning over and over again to find the answer. That's basically what you need. Is you need to massively it's called massively parallel computing, so that you can have basically thousands of computers working on this simultaneously, and it might run for maybe take a week or two to go through all of the data.
And you weren't the only biostatistician involved in this particular project.
No, absolutely not. So again, there was overall probably 100 researchers, and maybe 20% or 15% were biostatisticians. So it takes a team of biostatisticians to sort of tackle this problem.
Who's the conductor? Who helps orchestrate all this research so that you, for example, here in Milwaukee, aren't running the identical numbers that somebody in San Jose is?
So right, right. That's a good question. So it's not really there's no formal structure to it. Basically, it's a bunch of people who get together and decide to do this, and then they have conference calls. And we sort of divvy up the workload among us. So we have weekly phone calls where we just sort of informally divvy up the work and say, you run this part, I'll run this part, and then we meet again 2 weeks later and discuss the results.
And you're all using the same algorithms?
No, we could be using different algorithms, but in theory, they should all arrive at the same answer if they're all correct algorithms. We're all using different computers. We're all located in different institutions. So it is – it's actually a very good check, right? If I run something and somebody else in Los Angeles got the same exact answer, you're fairly confident in that.
Wow. How did you get into this field to begin with? I mean, I have to admit, I'm one of those people who's a little averse to math because it's not – I'm more of a word person than a number person. So I'm amazed, when I sit across from someone like you who is able to go ahead and use these marvelous tools to come up with answers that we otherwise might not have. Where did you get your start in this area?
So I, when I was in college, I was a math major, and that was just basically a byproduct of some professors, relationships with professors. I had some great math professors in college, and it just sort of tuned me in, and that's really where I got my start. And then I went to graduate school. I got a master's degree and then a doctorate and decided to focus in on statistics, particularly because of it just seemed very applied. You're doing data analysis and so forth. And then in the course of my research to gain my doctorate, I became very interested in these genetics questions because it seemed like a very interesting thing. It was a very up-and-coming sort of high-tech solution to these problems. And that's when I basically had to self-teach myself a lot of computer programming. That's kind of the crux of the matter is there's this type of work takes a lot of computing. So I really started off as a mathematician who sort of self-taught some computer programming skills and then learned genetics just in the course of my research because that's what I guess I was just attracted to that. I thought it was a very clean answer to to very perplexing problems, as you said earlier.
Have you taken any medical courses yourself? Do you have a good understanding of physiology or biology or chemistry?
I have a very weak understanding of these things. I've taken a couple of genetics courses in graduate school. But in my previous – before I came to UWM, I worked with a lot of medical doctors and epidemiologists for a solid 3 years. And that was a very good opportunity for me to learn sort of their language of physiology and disease and treatments and so forth. So that was, again, a more sort of an informal education.
Well, let me flip it around. How do the physicians that you work with react to your ability to use math and the amazing array of computers? I mean, are they math people? Do they get it?
It's highly variable. Some people are, some people aren't. I think that they all acknowledge the power of this, and I think they're all very excited about when we get a result such as this. They immediately see the potential to impact people's lives, and I think that that's a commonality with everyone that we all the physicians we work with. And some are math people, some aren't, and I think that's just sort of a representation of the population at large.
And that's the beauty, I suppose, of bringing people like you together, statisticians, with people from the healthcare professions, because you each bring a unique attribute or trait.
Absolutely. You simply can't do this sort of study without many different types of expertise. You need biologists and physicians and computer scientists and geneticists all working together to attain a similar goal.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Paul Auer. Paul is an assistant professor of biostatistics at the Zilber School of Public Health at UWM. He was recently a part of a team that discovered mutations linked to lower levels of triglycerides that could be a clue to better treatments for healthcare. The results of that study, just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and as we indicated a moment ago, has attracted a lot of attention around the world because this may be, just maybe, one of those silver bullets that could be used to go ahead and stamp out a disease that has taken such a toll on our society and societies around the world. Paul, talking about your background in mathematics and your work with the healthcare field, let's perhaps take the work that you just did on this triglyceride study, the genetic mutation finding, and let's step back now and see how that sort of work applies perhaps to other public health areas. What else could you use biostats in terms of building a better, healthier society beyond the health disease or heart disease that you have been studying?
Sure. So I guess there's multiple ways to answer this question. One is we don't have to just look at heart disease. So I'm also involved in many studies that are looking at development of cancer because we know that this method or this technique works to find genes linked to diseases. And so we think we can generalize it to many other types of diseases, so breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and so forth. So that's sort of more specifically how this work can be done. And generally, biostatistics is often used simply to answer questions about data that individuals have collected. So we have epidemiologists who perhaps will track a disease outbreak. And in order to do that, they're sort of collecting lots of data about how the disease is spreading throughout a population. And you need you basically need biostatistics in order to wade your way through that data and to pinpoint maybe the source of the outbreak.
Because there's a lot of noise, I suspect, in the discussion of what causes a disease. If you're just looking at one or a handful of real cases, real people who are presenting their symptoms and that obviously I want my doctor to look at my symptoms and deal with me, but that I may not be representative of the rest of the population that has a disease, correct?
Right, absolutely. So in public health generally, we often take this population-based stance. So we zoom way back from looking at particular individuals to populations in general. And it gets rid of some of this noise or overpowers some of this noise that you just described, where if we only look at a handful of people, you have something called a sample size problem. You're looking at too few individuals. And if you zoom back, you can sort of see patterns that aren't visible when you're only looking at, say, a handful of folks.
How difficult is it for you and other statisticians to get their hands on the raw data? Healthcare in particular is a field where privacy is of such utmost concern. You know, we all want to believe that what is going on in our lives is private between me and my doctor. How does a statistician get access to information that you need in order to do these massive studies of hundreds or thousands of people?
Yep, that's a great question. So typically, in order to gain access to these types of data, we go through a long process of data security, training, and basically paperwork and we have there are occasionally audits of your computer security and so forth to ensure that the proper privacy measures are being observed. If you work with anything with the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, that all requires that you go through all of this training and have all of your computers be secure and backed up, and that you observe all of these measures to protect individuals' privacies, because obviously this is of the utmost concern.
Are names involved here, or do you somehow hide or cover the actual identity of a person whose data you are using in one of these studies?
That's a great question. So typically, almost exclusively, we work with what's called de-identified data. So there's some sort of primary study that may have collected the medical information on these individuals. And they have the names and so forth, but I never have access to that sort of thing. Basically, what they've done is they've given them identifiers and then scrambled those identifiers, shuffled them in various ways, and then sent the shuffled data to me, because I don't need to know the names or the birth dates or anything else like that. And that's what I actually look at. That's what the statistician looks at, is this sort of de-identified data. It's basically impossible to re-identify an individual from the data that I have, that I work with.
As a statistician, does it ever feel a little strange to know that you're dealing with all of this information that ultimately is very personal, relates back to an individual who has a condition or is dealing with some sort of health situation, but they become anonymous on your spreadsheet. Do you ever step back and say, "Gee, I wonder who's behind these numbers?"
Sure, absolutely. Well, one thing that's sort of reassuring about this is that everyone whose data we look at, we know has given informed consent. So they've been explained what's going to happen, who's going to look at the data, and what for, and they've consented to that. And so that's one sort of nice reassurance that we have when, as the statistician, you say, okay, there's this person with this sort of rich personal history, and they have agreed to allow us to use their history to search for causes of disease. And that's a great thing. It's a very generous thing, actually.
Talk about the computers. You mentioned before that you may be running thousands of calculations simultaneously. What are you sitting in front of it? Is it a laptop? Is it a big supercomputer? What allows you to sort through these billions of bits of information?
Sure. So basically, what we have is a laptop. So if you just observe me working, you would just see me on a laptop. But the laptop is linked to essentially a supercomputer of sorts. These are called computer clusters. And they're basically, you could think of it as being 1,000 or 10,000 processors or laptops worth of computing energy or capacity. So I'm sitting on my laptop and I'm linked to this supercomputer. And the supercomputer, I just give commands. I send commands to the supercomputer, and the supercomputer sort of does all of the chugging away.
Is it difficult getting time on these computer banks?
Yeah. I mean, it's not free. Somebody has to pay for it. It depends. It's becoming a lot more ubiquitous. So these if you've heard of the cloud, the Amazon cloud operates huge server called server farms, and they rent space by the minute or hour, or so you can pay Amazon to have them run your computations. UWM has a cluster that we can use. Various institutions have things that like fee-for-service server farms, and so that's basically how it's done.
So your job might not have existed, 20 years ago without the computers that we have today?
Oh, absolutely not. Yes. There's no doubt about it. We rely completely on the latest computing technologies.
Now, we hear about the constant evolution in computers and how quickly we can go ahead and see capacity to process increase. Will your job get easier down the road as computers get better or faster?
Well, there's a sort of double-edged sword here, because as computers get faster, the data just gets bigger. And so actually the capacity for computers to grow and scale lags behind the capacity of technology to generate data. So my job will increasingly get more and more difficult, actually.
So where do you go from here? You talked about finishing up this heart study, other work that you're involved in at the Zilber School right now using your statistical background.
Right. So we're involved in a number of studies dealing with cancer. I'm also involved in another study that's looking at it's focused on postmenopausal women and which ones take hormone therapy and which ones do not, and if this has if there's a genetic component that protects them against developing heart disease and breast cancer. So that's a new interesting project that we're just starting.
At a place like Zilber here in Milwaukee, do you try to focus on studies that are centered here in Wisconsin, as it was the case with the heart study you just finished, are you looking at national or international studies?
Right. So we largely look very broadly across the whole U.S., and if we can bring we try our best to bring studies from or based in Milwaukee into the fold, and I think that's going to be a major push for us over the next few years, is to have Milwaukee be a major player in some of these studies and have the primary a large contribution come from Milwaukee.
And of course, with the Zilber School now in line or on track to become an accredited School of Public Health, that probably will only become easier as you have the official stamp or seal of approval to do even more work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we're looking forward to.
Paul, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation, and we wish you the very best as you search through those numbers. I'm glad you could do it. I can't, but amazing work, and congratulations on the work just published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Thanks very much. It was my pleasure to be here.
Paul Auer, Assistant Professor of Biostatistics at the Zilber School of Public Health at UWM, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We will see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.